Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. All right, quick. What does OFA stand for? Many of you probably think Obama for America, the organizing group that led the 2008 and 2012 election campaigns. But in 2009, OFA became Organizing for America. And just last month, OFA morphed yet again into Organizing for Action. Let's talk about why that matters with Nicholas Confessori, who writes about campaign finance and big money lobbying for the New York Times. The new OFA looks an awful lot like a traditional lobbying organization with some close ties directly to the Obama administration. But the administration is also banking on it being critical in advancing the second term agenda on gun control, climate change, and more. Hi, Nick. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay, so is it just a coincidence that we have OFA, then OFA, then OFA?
Well, it's not a coincidence, obviously, although in a certain sense, I think the administration and the Obama people want you to think of it as a coincidence. In a legal sense, this group is going to be not at all connected to the White House, independent, not really related to the Obama campaign for president. It is going to be a new group. The problem is, in effect, it is basically an extension of this administration.
After the 2012 election, we heard so much about how impressive the Obama campaign's data mining was. And I remember wondering what was going to happen to their massive database of voter information once the election was over. Is this the answer?
Well, apparently it's the answer that they've chosen. Essentially, they're going to raise money into a group whose legal structure is very similar to, say, the NRA or the Sierra Club. And they're going to raise large contributions and some small contributions to basically pay to keep this infrastructure together, to keep the software and the servers, to keep the lists. It's actually surprisingly expensive to keep a voter list up to date. It actually costs a lot of money, millions of dollars. It's a lot of what the parties spend money on when the parties are doing it. So this is their way of doing it. And what's interesting here, Brian, is they chose not to stick this thing into the Democratic National Committee. This is traditionally what a party does for an incumbent president. It holds on to the lists. It advocates for his agenda. It gets people out there kind of riled up and active on issues. But what he's decided to do is, unlike after his first campaign, when as you noted, Organizing for Action, whichever one it was called, Organizing for America, was basically folded into the DNC. This time they've said, you know what? We're going to spin it off. We're going to keep it separate. It's our own thing.
And this new group will take over the campaign infrastructure that is so big that it includes 2 million volunteers, 17 million email subscribers, and 22 million Twitter followers. And you reported that the group's initial goal is to raise $50 million for advocacy efforts, but that at least half of the group's budget will come from a select group of donors who will each contribute or raise $500,000 or more. So who are these big Democratic donors? And let's ask the obvious question, what do they get in return?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it will probably be a lot of the same people who showed up on those bundler lists and fundraiser lists that the campaign disclosed every quarter during the campaign. It'll be people who are close to the president, people on Wall Street, trial lawyers, people in unions maybe, people in Hollywood certainly. It'll be all the usual suspects. But there's one kind of important difference here. If you have a campaign or a party committee, there are really strict rules about how much you can raise and what you have to disclose about the money. There are also very strict rules that say a federal employee, like, say, a person in the White House, can't ask people for money for a campaign. It's illegal. You can go to jail if you do it. Those rules don't apply to a group like this. Now, I should note that the Obama people, that the White House has said that people in the White House are not going to fundraise for this group, although they will probably appear at events for donors, which is an important distinction. And the campaign and this new group, OFA, has said it will voluntarily disclose every quarter the names and some ranges of amounts raised and given by each of these donors. But it's all voluntary. It's all up to them. So they're going to police themselves. And I think we've seen sometimes that self-regulation is not the best kind of regulation for things like this.
So you're suggesting, I think, that this raises an ethical equivalency question for Democrats and progressives. If they're so upset about Citizens United, which allows these various 501c4 so-called independent groups to raise money without disclosing their donors, oh, look, Obama's doing it too.
Well, just to correct you on one thing, Brian, it's actually not connected to Citizens United, except in sort of a cultural sense that Citizens United was both a legal and cultural signal to everybody that if you were wealthy, you could play on a different level.
Mm-hmm.
501c4 groups existed before Citizens United, but actually no other incumbent president has kind of taken this route, I think for two reasons. One, it's dangerous, and it can get icky really fast if you're not careful. The danger here is that a person or company who wants to have favor with the White House can give them an unlimited amount of money, $10 million, let's say, even as they have things going on before the administration, and that people in the administration, even if they aren't specifically asking for the check, are going to be involved in appearing in events, prospecting events, let's say, with kind of some of these donors. And the rules are really unclear. It's kind of another world. Like, there isn't really any guide here. The second reason I think they're doing it is no one's actually ever had an organization like President Obama's. So it's not like past presidents wouldn't have tried to do this if they could, but Bill Clinton and George Bush didn't have this kind of organic structure of people who were, I think, quite so devoted to the guy up top, right? That's an important thing. It's an organic thing. It's a significant thing. So really, I think they had a problem, so to speak, a quandary that past presidents have not really faced, didn't have the luxury of facing. So they're trying to solve it in the way that they think is best, but it does raise some of these ethical questions, I think.
Right. And Obama is somebody who has repeatedly denounced Citizens United, said that it should be rolled back, wants other campaign finance-related restrictions. But if you remember, way back during the primaries in 2008, he reversed course on taking public matching funds in exchange for limiting spending once he realized what a campaign donation machine he was sitting on. So
right.
You had McCain as the Republican candidate adhering to those limits and Obama as the progressive Democrat not. And here, as you say, he's become the first incumbent president to use this kind of a machine.
It's hard not to really see this, Brian, as kind of the kind of fifth or sixth step away from the ambitious campaign reform goals that he outlined when he was running for president and kind of early in his first term. It's kind of been one thing after another. And yeah, you can say it was necessity. He opposed super PACs until the threat to him of Republican super PACs grew so great that he felt like he had to have his side organizing them. I think the public financing thing is going to be part of his legacy, as you point out. President Obama killed public financing. His decision not to take it changed the game. I don't think any candidate for federal office, for president, I should say, will ever accept public financing ever again. And it kind of knocks down a pillar of the post-Watergate reforms that were meant to try to staunch a little bit the flow of money and special interest money and influence into presidential campaigns. What's really left, all that's really left anymore, the post-Watergate reforms, are these limits on how much you can give directly to a candidate for office or to a party. And what he's done here is basically sidestep those limits.
And some of those are going before the Supreme Court to
that's
see
correct.
If they get overturned next. Well, listeners, on our website, we have an OFA reading list, links to Nick's reporting on the Times site, other resources on lobbying efforts, and more information about OFA itself. Let's see, if you give $500,000 to an independent 501c4, can you get a night in the Lincoln bedroom?
Well, I'm not sure if it's going to be a night, but certainly you can get a meeting with the president with a large group of other people who have given $500,000 or raised $500,000.
Nick Confessori, reporting on campaign finance and big money lobbying for the New York Times. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we begin a month-long series called Ask a Bioethicist. Today, your questions about reproductive technology, like is it ethical to genetically engineer a baby? If you have a bioethical question relevant to reproductive technology that you would like to ask, you can call in right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-WNYC. 9692, and we will debut our series, Ask a Bioethicist, right after this.